Good morning. I ask you to open the Bible this morning, book of 1 Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Timothy 2. That's where we're going to read in just a moment. We'll jump around the Bible a little bit today, but we're going to start there in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Good to see you. Glad that you are here. We've got visitors among us. I want you to know how glad that we are you're worshiping God with us today. If you didn't get a visitor's packet already, we hope you'll get one before you leave. They're actually available at all three exits of the auditorium. In that packet, you're going to find a light blue visitor's card. We'd love for you to fill it out. You can throw it in one of those collection boxes. They are by where you pick up the packets, and that'd be a way for us to know that you were here today, and especially if you want us to contact you or have any questions you want to ask us, or we'd be happy to know about that as well. We're glad you're here today. 1 Timothy chapter 2. When it comes to the issue of modesty, of how we dress, when you just stop and think about it, we live in a culture that is rampantly immodest, that has defined decency down in all sorts of astounding ways. I still remember years ago when one of my kids was preschool age, and they were riding in the back seat, and I was driving down the road, and I hear this little voice from the back, and the voice says to me, "Dad, why does that lady have no clothes on?" And I looked up, and we were driving past a billboard. It was a beer billboard, some brand of beer, and it was a woman in a bikini. I thought it was interesting that an innocent preschool-aged child could recognize what that was for what it is. That woman really had no clothes on. Was she completely naked? No, but close enough that my child, innocent of sexuality from the back seat, wanted to know why she wasn't wearing clothes. It's rampant in our culture. Perhaps maybe some of us have become desensitized to it, come to think that this level of undress and unveiling of the human body is normal, or that it somehow doesn't affect us and warp us in mind and heart. The New Testament talks about modesty, and usually when we hear the topic of modesty come up, some of us perhaps begin to roll our eyes or groan in our heads. Here we go. Listen, this isn't a lesson about you know, measuring lines and where the line is. Not going to draw a line for you this morning. I want to take a different approach to modesty. That's why I'm calling this the spirit of modesty. I'm not going to get out of a ruler. We're not going to measure hemlines and debate how much is too much in any way. Not going to give any rules this morning. Going to open God's word. I'm going to try to give you some principles by which you can make some holy decisions about how you dress yourself. And so we're starting 1 Timothy chapter 2 this morning. Oh, well, I always make fun of David for this. Now it's happened to me. Justice. 1 Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. Likewise, Paul writes and says, "I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness or God-orientedness." If you're oriented towards God, it's going to affect how you work. Now, yes, Paul's talking to women here. And I want you to notice, though, I want you to notice what Paul puts on the table. It's kind of interesting. Maybe some of you have already picked up on this even as I read that. It's rather interesting, isn't it? And this is almost always the case in the New Testament in the very few passages where the topic of modesty comes up, that almost always Paul is talking about overdressing, not underdressing. Here in this context, he's telling women not to overdo it, to dress modestly and discreetly, not with the fancy hair and the gold and pearls and costly garments. And so we begin to recognize that literally modesty can be a matter of, in our time in particular, wearing too little. In the ancient world, wearing too much, dressing ostentatiously, wearing way too much. In the world of scarcity in the ancient world, perhaps the greater risk back then was to overdress for the same purpose, though, as sometimes people underdress today, which is this. And here's the principle of modesty writ large: to draw attention to yourself for your appearance. In our culture, where everybody's got some jewelry, where everybody can pull out their credit card and go to the store and buy a fancy dress, even if it is on credit and you're charging it, overdressing isn't nearly the thing anymore, though we can still do that. I'll say some more about that in a minute. But in our culture, how do we draw attention to ourselves instead? We do it by, you know, if you've got it, flaunt it. That's the saying in our culture, right? If you've got it, show it off. Draw attention by your physical assets. Too often is the idea. Wearing too much or wearing too little. Right here, though, we get the idea. But at the end of the day, it's about drawing attention to yourself. That is the essence of immodesty, drawing attention to yourself. And so in a world of decadent abundance, if in the ancient world where scarcity was the rule, where very few people had nice clothes or had any amount of jewelry, pearls, gold, what have you, in that world, that was a way you could draw attention to yourself, was by overdoing it. In our world, it's by showing off your assets, your physical body, your physical beauty that God has gifted you with. And so in a world of decadent abundance like we live in now, we show our bodies to pursue the blatantly sexual attention our culture has taught us to crave. Immodesty is wearing too little is driven by our culture's obsession with the sexualization of everything. Even the innocent young child, I'll tell you, those of you who are parents, you know how hard it is to shop for a young daughter these days and try to find clothing that is decent and modest, that's not too tight or not revealing, or is it not in some way intentionally sexualizing your daughter? Because here's the thing, folks, and the Bible makes this very clear. While the Bible never gives you exactly how many inches or how many square inches of skin you can show or how high the hem can come, the Bible makes this very clear in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, where Paul, in describing the body, yes, he's making an analogy to the church, but he makes this telling observation about the human body, that there are parts of the body that seem to be weaker, but they're really indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think are less honorable, we bestow the greater honor. But listen now, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty. Here's the bottom line. While the Bible never gives you exactly the line, the Bible makes very clear this: there are parts of your body that ought not be seen, that are unpresentable. Doesn't mean that there's something wrong or ugly. It means they're not meant to be seen by others. Something too private for public exposure. And that's the reality. Because here's the thing, I want you to stop and think about when this whole issue of nakedness really kind of becomes an issue. It goes all the way back to the beginning, right? Remember the story? How do we get going? God makes Adam and Eve, and they're perfect in the garden. And both of them, remember Genesis 1 and 2 when they're first made, both of them in their sinless innocence are what? What does the text say? They're naked and unashamed. But then what happens? Then they sin against God in Genesis chapter 3. You remember the story. They both eat of the forbidden fruit. And then chapter 3 and verse 7 of Genesis, the eyes, when both of them had sinned, when their innocence was gone, the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And so they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves covering. So in the Bible, literally, there is this initial correlation. It literally goes back to the moment when humans fell from their created perfection. Sin led to the awareness of nakedness, which led to a sense of shame. This ought to be covered for both men and women. Both of them wanted leaves to cover up the unpresentable parts, even though they were married. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And so we wrestle. What was it? And maybe you've sometimes wrestled. What was it about sin? What was it in that move from Genesis 2 to Genesis 3, where at one point when they're sinless, they're naked and unashamed, but once sin enters the picture, now their consciousness of how unveiled and exposed they are, and they both want to cover it up. What is it in that moment? Why does the Bible tell the story that way? Why is nakedness and shame the first real instance or the first real awareness of their fallenness now? And perhaps it's this. Before they sinned, before they came to that tragic knowledge of good and evil, before they realized what evil can be and what's possible, before they rebelled against God, before they knew good and evil, they also therefore did not know that sexual desire will be in one sense, almost the quintessential human perversion. That sexual desire and sexuality can be directed towards very evil ends and purposes. So much exploitation would happen in human history through abused sexuality. So much rape and abuse would happen through distorted sexuality. They had no cause to be ashamed of the fact they were naked because they had no idea that sexuality could be perverted as much as it has been in our world down to this day. And so there's literally, and once we stop and think about it, it's kind of fascinating. The awareness of nakedness and the shame that came with it is tied to the fact that they had a knowledge that was not theirs to have. They now knew things that God did not want humans to know. They had attained to a level of knowledge of good and evil that was not meant for humans. And in that awareness, in those eyes that had now been tragically opened, they realized that there were things that we really aren't meant to know about each other, things that can be perverted and abused and distorted in horrific ways. Now, here's the thing. There certainly are some cultural aspects to modesty. How the world communicates sexuality and sexual desire and sexual desirability. How the world on the other side, when we talk about overdressing, how the world communicates wealth and status. Because that's what overdressing indicates, right? I'm better off than you are. Look at me because I have things you don't. Look at me because I can afford things you can't have. That's the essence of overdressing. Just as the essence of underdressing is perhaps saying, look at me and look at what I have physically that maybe you don't have. There are certainly some aspects culturally to modesty and how we display it. I mean, I think about fads and clothing. Let's talk about overdressing for a moment. Fads and clothing, right? That comes and goes. I mean, listen, when our children laugh at our high school yearbooks because we thought we were so cool the way we dressed at 16 or 17, and our kids can't believe that we used to wear our pants that way or wear shirts in that color or whatever it may be. Or you think about this. When you were back in high school, you remember the labels, the name brands that were really something that all the cool kids wore that don't even exist today except in Wikipedia memory? And so, yeah, there is a sense in which overdressing and underdressing, there is a certain cultural aspect to this where fads and fashion come and go. Clothes, even those that cover the body that are still used to signal who's in and who's out, who's well off and who's not. Styles that are designed to socially exclude because someone can't afford certain brands. That all changes over time. Certainly. And when it comes to sexual desirability, standards change. I mean, think about it. To this day, in certain parts of the world, a woman displaying her hair publicly is considered inappropriate. It's considered immodest. It's considered drawing sexualized attention to the woman. So there are a lot of cultures in the world still to this day in which women are expected to keep their hair covered. Though there's nothing inherently immodest about it. I mean, I think about the story in Jesus' day in Luke chapter 7 where Jesus was dining with a Pharisee. There was the sinful woman, well known in the city to be a sinful woman. And she comes and she wets Jesus' feet with her tears, having anointed him with perfume and began to wipe his feet with her hair. And of course, the people in the room, the Pharisee most of all, are scandalized that Jesus would permit a woman who is a well-known sinner to touch him. But certainly we're meant to understand culturally the horror of that as well. She's got her hair exposed and she's rubbing it all over his feet. We see it today as an act of humility, and certainly it was. But it was also a very immodest act by their cultural standards for a woman to display her hair in such a way in public. Oh, the scandal of this woman's let down, uncovered hair. Oh, he doesn't even realize. I mean, surely now he gets she's a sinful woman who would act this way. See, by the rules approach to immodesty in their culture, she's immodest because she broke the rule. A woman's not supposed to show her hair. But in reality, she wasn't really immodest because she was showing great humility. And Jesus sees her act for what it was, for what it is. Because in ancient culture, and you can even still see this today in conservative Islamic societies, conservative Orthodox Jewish communities, a woman's hair is considered sexual, not to be shown publicly, because that's immodest. And by the way, if you think we're completely different, that in kind of more secular societies like ours, a woman's hair isn't sexual, and that's why we let it down. It can still be sexualized. That's what our culture does. Our culture sexualizes everything. You ever seen a shampoo commercial where the woman has gotten through washing her hair, and she's shaking her hair in slow motion? You can see every follicle almost. Why do we do that? Because it's not about just having clean hair, is it? It's about this adds to a certain sexual desirability if you do this. See, in our culture, we could take anything that's even should be innocent. This shampoo makes clean hair, but it also makes you sexually desirable. That's the world we live in, folks, where everything is sexualized. And so even in commercial, a woman's long flowing hair being shaken around because it's clean, because this brand really works, is now something that's intended to create illicit sexual desire in somebody who is not her husband. By the way, you know how you know something's been sexualized in our culture? You'll know it's been sexualized in our culture when you will only or primarily in ads or on TV see a woman doing it. I've never seen a shampoo commercial where a man shakes his hair slowly after he's gotten through washing. And so it's because most of us don't have, after a certain age, a lot of hair left. It'd be a very short commercial. But stop and think about it. Why is it that it's always the woman who does it and never the man? Because that commercial is inherently immodest. Even though nothing truly sexualized, truly sexual, no part that ought to be remain covered has been shown. But it's immodest. Do you get that? Do you see that? Do you understand the deeper idea of what's immodest? It's about drawing attention for a sexualized purpose. It's really, at the end of the day, about an attitude, about a disposition. Listen to Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. But look what he says next. He says, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding hair, wearing gold jewelry, putting on dresses. Look, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. In this way also, in the former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves as they were submissive to their own husbands. It's literally not so much about what you wear even. It's about how that reveals what the real you is. Maybe those fancy clothes are a coping mechanism for insecurity. You believe you have to look beautiful, or if you're a man, you have to look handsome. You have to get respect and be noticed by how you dress, because you don't believe in your own personal worth in the eyes of God. Because you don't believe that a gentle and quiet spirit or humility before God, men and women, is itself inherently beautiful. And with the heavenly eyes that see beyond the appearance of the external to what we really are, what's beautiful and what's not, what's attractive and what's not, what draws the eyes of heaven may well not be what draws the eyes of men. And so there is a certain consciousness we need to have about how the world perceives us, and maybe how we perceive ourselves, and how our self-perception drives how we dress or undress, as the case may be. Because there is a sense in which clothing does communicate something. There's a reason that the military requires its soldiers and officers to wear uniforms. Because it communicates something. In some cases, it communicates rank. Sometimes, especially in the battlefield, it just communicates we're all in this together. But at the end of the day, it means something. There's a reason. There's a reason that sometimes there are dress codes in the workplace. You just can't show up tomorrow morning in shorts and a t-shirt, can you? You may be, in one sense, physically covered, but you're not modest in that environment. It'll draw attention to you. And again, why aren't you not able to show up in shorts and a t-shirt in your workplace tomorrow, wherever it is and whatever you may be doing? Because it communicates something about how you value the work, the place, the people around you. It communicates something about how you view your responsibility in that place. Clothing sets an atmosphere. That's why sometimes we tell our kids to tuck in your shirt, wear a belt. Or sometimes there's a sign on the door when you go into a convenience store, you know what it says. No shirt, no shoes, no service. Because listen, even in a decadent culture, there's got to be some limits. There's got to be some lines we don't cross. Because this word that's used here, holy women, that Peter uses, that's really the key to modesty. If modesty, both overdressing and underdressing, is really about drawing attention to ourselves for the wrong reasons in the wrong way, if that's the essence of immodesty, then what's the opposite? The opposite of immodesty is holiness. It's God-orientedness. It's recognizing that you are set apart, and how you dress does communicate something about how you see yourself before God and how you want to represent yourself and therefore God to the world. Holiness is the key to separateness to the world. It's a fascinating story. Going back to Genesis chapter 38, kind of a little bit of a parenthesis in the Joseph story. Joseph's brother Judah had sons. And at the end of the day, bottom line is two of his sons had died. One of them left behind a widow. Judah had promised that widow that she could marry his youngest son, who was not yet of age to be married. Yet as the years went by, rather than keeping his word to his daughter-in-law, his widowed daughter-in-law, Judah never provided for her the next son as a next husband. And so eventually she got very frustrated, she got very bitter, and she decided to ambush Judah. And she does it in a very odd kind of way. It's another story for another day, why, you know, you would get even with your father-in-law this way, but she does this. Chapter 38, beginning verse 14, she took off her widow's garments. Because think about that. And by the way, she'd been a widow a long time. Think about that. How you dress communicates a message. How did you know she was a widow? The way she dressed. And she laid aside those garments. She covered herself with a veil and she wrapped herself. I want you to notice that everything she does clothing-wise is about covering up. And yet in this story, she's going to be immodest. Everything she's doing physically is putting more on. She puts a veil on. She wraps herself. And she sits in the gateway of Enayim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah, that's this next son of Judah's, had grown up. And she had not been given him as a wife. She's frustrated. Judah didn't keep his word to me. So when Judah saw her, think about this, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. Isn't that ironic? In the modern world, you know how you know somebody's a prostitute when you're in the wrong part of town? By the fact that they're advertising what they can offer you by the way they dress. You know how you knew somebody was a prophet in the ancient world? They hid their face so you wouldn't know who it was. Isn't that ironic? But the bottom line is every culture's got a way of communicating what you're about by how you dress. And he knew she was a prostitute by the way she dressed. She was plenty covered up, but she was immodest because the way she dressed advertised to others, I am sexually available. And so he did what so many men have done over the course of history, exploited the woman sexually. He turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come into you. Because of course, given the way prostitutes would dress to maintain a certain level of anonymity, he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So Tamar dresses like a prostitute, even though she's thoroughly covered up. She was immodest, even though she was more covered up than usual. That's the irony. But she was sending a message, a culturally acknowledged message, that dressing this way says to everyone who sees her, I am sexually available. And so that's the thing about modesty, you got to understand. There's always a message in what you wear, whether you think about it or not. There's the message others are receiving, whether you want to stop and think about it or not. Regardless of whether you are intending to send it or not, certain ways of dressing, just common sense, communicate certain things. You can say to your boss when you go in shorts and a t-shirt to the meeting tomorrow, I meant no disrespect. And maybe you didn't, but you know what everyone in the room is going to think, especially your boss when the corporate guys flew in for this meeting? What's he going to think? He's going to be embarrassed at your immodesty. And he's going to say, well, you should have known, because sometimes, yes, I can't help what everybody thinks about everything, but sometimes there's just some God-given common sense where I ought to be able to see how people are going to perceive the way I am clothing myself. It is going to be taken this way. There's simply no excuse for being shocked when people are put out when I'm in shorts and a t-shirt at the big corporate meeting tomorrow. I should have recognized that people are going to say, that's disrespectful. That's not taking it seriously. And so it happens all the time, in one sense. You know, sometimes part of what makes it immodest is the message that we communicate to others. Think about tourists in foreign countries who inadvertently insult native cultures without realizing it, because how you dress and act communicates something to people. And so here's the whole issue. If it was really about, you know, to use Peter's words about modest dress, which is really about the inner person and what you want to show to the world, Peter used that word of 1 Peter 3 about holy women. The real point of modesty then is this: if holiness is about separateness, being different, not playing by the world's rules and values and desires, accenting God, not sin in the fallenness of the age, then the real point of modesty is to communicate God's values to the world. The way I dress shows I understand what decency is, what sexual perversity is. I'm not going to participate in that. I'm not going to unveil myself in such a way. I'm not going to give needless offense in how I dress. I'm not going to overdo it either. I'm not going to engage in the whole world's materialism, where at the same time we live in a world that in one sense revels in displaying nakedness or near nakedness, but on the other side revels in showing off designer labels and fancy clothes as a way of making myself feel and seem better than others. That's still the world we live in. And modesty is about communicating God's values to the world, avoiding sexual immorality on the other hand, and avoiding greed and covetousness on the other. That's what modesty is about, being holy, communicating God's values to the world by the way we dress, rather than communicating the world's values by the way we dress. And so I'm not going to overdress in pride and anger and arrogance and the world's materialism, where I covet clothes and labels because that's what's in or cool or fashionable this month. And I'm not going to underdress either in sexualization and lust and play that game either. I'm going to dress in a way that says I'm not from around here. Just like sometimes a foreigner looks out of place in the country they're visiting because of the way they dress, my dress is going to mark me out in this world as different as well. You know how sometimes people realize the man was a prophet? Because he wore camel skins and a leather belt. And at one point, one of the kings of Israel asked his men to describe the man that they had seen who had given a harsh message, and they described how he dressed. The king said, "Oh, that's Elijah. He doesn't dress like the rest of us." And maybe sometimes, folks, that's the way we need to recognize, is that we don't learn to dress, whether it's overdressing or underdressing. We don't learn to dress the way the world dresses. We learn to dress in a way that communicates God's values to the world, which, by the way, means we're not always going to look like everybody else. And so let me make a couple of observations as we kind of wrap this up this morning. Again, to think about modesty, then you got to think about the message you intend to send. You got to stop and be intentional. Just like you're getting ready for an interview, that's one of those times when you actually really do put some thought into how you dress, right? You worry about, you know, do my clothes match? Do my socks match my pants? You actually think about when you're going for that job interview, because you know that part of how that potential employer sees you is not just what you say and not just what your resume is, but do you look the part of a future employee at that company? Do you fit like what they think an employee of this place ought to look like? And you're going to dress as best you can understand what they're looking for. You're going to dress that way when you show up that day for that interview. You think about what you're going to wear and the message it's going to send. And we need to do that more and more every day, folks, because if you don't live intentionally, you're going to live worldly. The world's culture is that strong. We're surrounded by it that much. When a preschooler in the backseat of a car can say, "Dad, that lady's got no clothes on," it tells you that we're being shaped from the beginning of our awareness as human beings to look and think and act in worldly ways. So you think about the message you intend to send. You need to think about the message others are receiving. Yes, I know. Sometimes people shouldn't look and shouldn't lust. I get that. That's on them. But we shouldn't put the temptation in their place either. All of us need to think, all of us, men and women, need to think about the message that we are sending to others, what they are taking away from how we dress and what it communicates. And again, that could be overdressing as much as underdressing. If I'm dressing in a way that makes others feel inferior to me on purpose, if I'm dressing in a way that flaunts that I have more than others do, and I kind of take a subtle satisfaction in that in my heart, never would admit that, but it's true. You need to think about the message you're sending to others and how they're going to receive it. And again, we need to remember that the real point of modesty is this: whether it's overdressing or underdressing, I've got to communicate God's values to the world. It's not about the greed of overdressing. It's not about the sexualization of underdressing. I'm a different person from a different place. And the real purpose of clothes is simply this: to keep me from being naked. That's the point. That's the point. And, you know, a little stylish, you know, a little color matching, that's fine. But at the end of the day, we need to never lose sight of, you know, why did God give Adam and Eve the first set of clothes in human history? To cover their nakedness. And so the spirit of modesty can be summarized this way. At least this is what I want you to take home with you this morning. Number one, while I'm not going to draw it for you because I'm trying to get you to understand the biblical principles and mindset behind modesty. Number one, rest assured there is a line that can be crossed. I'm not going to draw it for you this morning. You'll answer to God someday for the decisions you make about that. But if there are parts of the body that Paul could call in 1 Corinthians 12 unpresentable, that ought not be seen, then rest assured there's a line that can be crossed. And I feel safe in saying this much, and in our culture we're way past it. And it's been normalized in our culture. And so sometimes maybe we can just say a few things about that, you know, some common sense. Number one, if in any other context what you're wearing qualifies as underwear, you ought not be wearing it in public. Or number two, if it shows something that ought to be part of the wedding night only, you ought not be wearing it. If the shame of nakedness in Genesis was tied to the knowledge that we were not meant to have, then think about it this way. Immodest dressing is giving away the visual knowledge of someone's body that others are not meant to have. There are some things about your body I shouldn't know, so please don't show me and tell me about it. And I'll tell you, fathers in particular, our wives ought not bear the burden alone of policing our daughter's dress. Our daughters get a very perverted message from the world about what their worth lies in, about what constitutes beauty and desirability. It affects their self-esteem, their self-image. And fathers in particular, what we need to do is we need to read the Song of Songs with attentiveness and then ask ourselves how that applies to what our daughters are wearing. If you read certain sections of the Song of Songs slowly and with imagination, then ask yourself, if that's how it really works, do I want my daughter showing this or flirting with this in any way? And by the way, it works that way for men too. Men, we need to recognize that while stereotypically men are more prone to be visual than women, men need to recognize that sometimes the way we dress can make it awkward for women as well. There are sections in the Song of Songs in which the woman describes her beloved's physical attractiveness to her. And maybe we should read places like Song of Songs 5 as men and remind ourselves that there are certainly ways in which we need to take into account how we dress and whether we're wearing too little sometimes. Our lines are too high or cut too close or a little too tight, and thus causing problems for women as well. Because at the end of the day, there is a line that can be crossed. So that's what we've got to remember, and that's what we've got to understand. Because the problem with immodesty is it gives the wrong people the wrong knowledge of things that they are not supposed to know if you're not married to them. Number two, though, you need to recognize that your dress conveys your values, and that's true whether you realize it or not. The way you dress shows what world you live in, what world you shape by, what culture you're a part of. Again, in 1 Peter 3, they were holy women who dressed differently. We dress in a way, if we're not careful, it says we agree with the world and the pride of labels and ostentatious adornment. Or if we're not careful, we dress in a way that says I agree with the world about what's sexy and desirable and drawing people's attention to me that way, because that's where my self-worth comes from, is the fact that people lust after me and I know it. And so if we're willing to be honest with ourselves sometimes, one of the ways that the world affects and infects us is that we are sometimes not ashamed and embarrassed at things we ought to be ashamed and embarrassed about. You know, again, the real goal of holiness is to reflect God's values, but to do that, you've got to have God's values in yourself. In other words, if it's something that embarrasses God, you need to be embarrassed about it. And if something the world's embarrassed about, but God's not, then you shouldn't be embarrassed about it either. I think about what Jeremiah says, and God through Jeremiah, to their dying culture. God asks rhetorically in Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, were the people ashamed because of the abomination they have done? They were not even ashamed at all. They didn't even know how to blush. Therefore, they shall fall among those who fall. At the time that I punish them, they shall be cast down. One of the ways that you knew the people of God were lost by Jeremiah's day was that the things that horrified and made God embarrassed were no longer embarrassing to them. They didn't even know how to blush about it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to be very careful that we do not repeat that in our own day and age, and we are the people of God who have lost the ability to blush, to be embarrassed at the things that we ought to be embarrassed about, and how we dress, and how we act, and what we want, and what we desire, and what we place our hope and our trust. God says, you ought to be embarrassed. You don't even know how to turn a rosy cheek anymore. How you dress conveys your values, who your God is, what country you really live in. Number three, our manner of dress, again, is always sending a message to someone. And number four, issue for Christians, I think, can be summarized this way. How will others be impacted by the message I am sending with my clothes? If clothing really is, in one sense, an extension of ourselves, a message about who we are and what's important to us and who we want to fit in with, then we need to think very carefully about what our clothes say about that. And you need to understand that it's not just about, you know, well, I have a right to do this and nobody has a right to judge me. No. At the end of the day, it's what would God say about me? If Jesus came back and I was wearing this and I had to go to judgment day in these clothes at this moment, standing before all heaven and earth, the angelic host, standing in front of all the great God-fearing men and women of the ages, well, I want to be wearing the latest fashion trends out of pride, all of a sudden realizing it doesn't look so good next to white robes given by God himself? Or would I be really desperate for one of those white robes, wishing I really had covered up a little more? At the end of the day, if you wouldn't want to be caught standing before God in judgment day because your clothing says I'm proud and arrogant, covetous and greedy, because I place my self-esteem and my self-value in the things of the world, or because I value sexualization, and boy, is it kind of awkward to be sexualized when I'm standing before the God who made me. You think very careful about the message I'm sending right now with my clothes. I get it. Sometimes we wish it were about the rules. Just tell me the lines. How much can I get away with? But that's not the way God really wants to do it in the Bible. Rules, strict lines, if I tell you just this many inches or this much flesh, and that's how much you can do. This much money on clothes and no more, that's the limit. You know, don't wear anything more than that, costs more than, and fill in the dollar amount. If we wanted to just make this about rules, draw lines, set limits, the problem with the rule-based approach is it doesn't bring about maturity. Rules don't bring maturity the way principles do, and learning to live in light of principles and think in terms of principles and shape heart in terms of principles and then live in light of those principles applied. That's why the New Testament is so much more principle-based in some ways than specific rule-based like the law of Moses was. Because what God really wants to do is shape the mind and the heart. Why do you want to, this morning in what we're talking about, dress the way you do? Because you learned this way from the world? Or because you read the Bible, absorbed God's values about overindulgence, about over-sexualization? You blush where God blushes. Don't want to be overdressed. Don't want to be underdressed. I want to dress like one of God's holy people. I want to be one of those people who, when others say, who is that? Say, oh, that's God's person. Just like in Elijah's day, they could figure out it was Elijah because he didn't dress like the rest of them. And again, I'm not doing it for attention, for myself. If there's any attention, it's attention reflected back to God. Because what people really see is not he thinks he's better than us or she thinks she's better than us. This is somebody who lives by a different code, by a different book, who comes from a different place and is headed to a different place. That's what holiness is all about. God help us to be a holy people in a fallen world. We're going to sing a song here, and this song is your opportunity to get right with God. If you need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ this morning, this song is your opportunity. If you have been thinking about the story of Jesus, about what he came to this world to do, what he accomplished at the cross and his resurrection, and you're ready to act on that knowledge this morning, we'd be happy to hear your confession of his name. And as you repent of your sins, we'll baptize you for those sins' forgiveness this morning. Here's when you're a child of God already, but in some way you've lost your holiness. You have a foot back in the world and it's affected who you are, how you're living, and you need to get back on the straight and narrow path. Get all your toes back in line with God's ways. We'll help you with that. We'll pray with you for you about whatever's on your heart and mind. If you want to share it with us right now, while we stand in the walls.